Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we are going to discuss what I described as the neutron bomb dropped in Europe, which belied the fact that we're apparently in recovery. We have this idea that there's economic recovery, inflation is a bit too low, but otherwise things look peachy keen. You've got sovereign bond yields in Italy and Spain plumbing historic all-time lows. The bond yields in Ireland actually on the 10-year now at the same rate as those in the U.S. So apparently everything looks fine, and yet we find that the ECB did something quite extraordinary. In fact, extraordinary is too soft a term. It's unprecedented. We now have negative interest rates for those banks, member banks, that are keeping their reserves and excess reserves, as we might call them, at the ECB. So that's one thing that we saw as well. There were now, I believe, what else did they put up? Oh, maybe they're going to allow for more open-ended purchases of government bonds, maybe. They're going to make more long-term loans to banks. They're going to accelerate plans to purchase some asset-backed securities, other stimulus measures. Well, to help us parse through this and understand it, our favorite European correspondent, Alistair MacLeod. Alistair, so good to have you again.
Thank you very much, Chris. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, well, you've just come off holiday and you're all rested. And the next thing you know, we've got what I'm describing as a bombshell. How do you see this move by the ECB? Is this just another reasonable step that a prudent bank might take because they're taking a cautious, if prudent, approach to how things are going? Or does it signal perhaps maybe they're a bit worried about something?
I'm afraid it's the latter, in my opinion. And in fact, I think it's so terrifying, I think I'd rather wish I was back on holiday. No, but seriously, this has been telegraphed for some time. Yeah. And I think that the ECB knew that this would be too much of a bombshell to surprise the markets with. You've got, if you like, a bit of a conflict. In fact, you've got several conflicts going on. The ECB has been primarily responsible for keeping the bond yields of the countries which are in trouble extremely low. They have been in the market basically buying those bonds. Now, so far, when they've bought those bonds, they've shifted other bonds out from their balance sheet to make way from them so that the bond purchases were sterilized. They have stopped sterilizing those bond purchases. So, in effect, we already have the beginnings of QE from the ECB. And they stated that this is, I mean, they're great for initials, these people. I hate it because you get these initials and then you forget what they are and you think, oh my God, I've got to look it up again. But anyway, there's something called the Securities Markets Program, and that's where they buy sovereign debt from issuing governments, rather against their mandate, I have to say, but they neutralize it by selling other bonds. Now, that sterilization is ending. So we've now got, in effect, naked QE. How much, I don't know, because they've got to manage a balance sheet, remember, and that is quite a problem.
So the sterilization is you buy one, you sell one. You buy
exactly
a sovereign bond of some kind, but you sell something else that you have in your portfolio. And so what they're really doing is picking, they want these bond yields to go down, but maybe they're willing to let these other ones go up. It was it that form of sterilization?
Well, in effect, no. It hasn't been, I think, so much trying to manage these rates. But what they have tried to do, if you like, is give the market the confidence, yeah, in, say, the Portuguese bond market, the Spanish bond market, so that others could come in and buy the sovereign debt. Because remember, under the Basel III agreement, sovereign debt takes no haircut. Now, that is fine as long as you are happy that your capital is protected. And in effect, the ECB has said to the banking system, we will ensure whatever it takes, was the actual phrase about a bit over a year ago, whatever it takes, we will ensure that the Eurozone sticks together and that none of these countries are going to fall over. That's That was the implication. So as a result, by going into the market and steering the market, buying a bit here, buying a bit there, they have been able to encourage banks, not only European banks, but banks from elsewhere in the world, to invest their euro holdings in sovereign debt. And of course, I mean, if you buy German debt, I can't remember, I think 10 years about 1.4% or something like that. So instead, what you do is you maybe look at Spanish or Italian debt, knowing that the ECB is in there guaranteeing, in inverted commas, your position. So that's what they've been doing. But the other side of it, of course, because they are not allowed to do QE, other side of it is they have had to sell some bonds to make way for it. Now, the overall effect, that which they've managed very effectively, is to keep yields effectively down. Now we have a situation where they're not going to sell any bonds to buy more sovereign debt. So you can see that we've now got, in effect, an open-ended QE. It's not stated how much it is. That will depend on how the balance sheet develops, because they've got an asset side and a liability side on their own balance sheet to manipulate or to handle. So that is, I think, the important point about QE. I think the reason we've got into this silly situation, Chris, is you've got a two-way pull. On the one hand, you've got the central bank saying we need to get this economy going, which basically means that banks have got to lend to non-financial corporations in the EU in order to get these economies going. This is the sort of standard central bank mantra. But the banks, on the other hand, in Europe are horrendously overgeared. I mean, when you look at a large bank like Deutsche Bank and you see its balance sheet is something like 55 times geared, I mean, it is enormous. The European banks have, on the whole, not managed to repair their balance sheets since the Lehman crisis in the way in which US banks have. Now, this leaves the EU banking system fundamentally weak and vulnerable. And the banks know it. And they would rather hold sovereign debt guaranteed by the ECB. They would rather put money on deposit with the ECB in order to lessen the systemic risk, because otherwise they'll lend it out to their peers and through the interbank market. And they're now being told, look, we will charge you for the facility. Again, what they're trying to do is they're trying to encourage banks to lend to the non-financial sector. Now, there is another aspect of this, and that is that they are making money available under something called the Targeted Long-Term Refinancing Operations, which you'll see in initials as TLTRO. Now, under this, a bank can borrow from the ECB the equivalent of 7% of a bank's loans to the non-financial sector, excluding mortgage lending, at 10 basis points above the ECB's base rate of 0.15%. In other words, if you're a bank, a Eurozone bank, you can borrow from the ECB at 0.25% for 4 years until September 2018. Now, the initial size of this facility is 400 billion euros, but there will be further tranches available in September and December. So you can see that, you know, here we have the ECB on the one hand, they've got the problem, or the banks in the system have got the problem that some of the biggies are horrendously overgeared. But unless they get the economy going, the whole thing's going to fall over. So, you know, don't worry about the gearing, lads. We'll make the money available. Just go out and lend it. So you can see that this is a very serious development. And just to give you a little bit of a flavor for the problem from the ECB's point of view, inflation in the European Monetary Union has fallen to roughly 0.5%. Now, this is against a target of 2%. Now, bear in mind that the next set of bank balance sheet stress tests assumes the most extreme adverse scenario is an inflation rate of 1%. We are already at 0.5%. Now, the problem here is that from the ECB's point of view, they are looking at something which is terrifying them, and that is deflation. If you get deflation, then sovereign debt ratios are likely to spiral yet higher despite any austerity packages that countries like Spain or Italy might bring in. So I hope that gives you a flavour for the background to the situation. The other thing is that, I mean, they really are making money available for banks. There's another horrible acronym, the FRFA, which is the Prolonged Fixed Rate Full Allotment. Now, banks under this program can continue to borrow as much as they want at a fixed low rate instead of bidding for funds available. Because usually what happens is the ECB would say, right, this week we're going to make 50 billion euros available for banks who want to bid for it. And they will come in and they will bid, and they will bid sort of, you know, 0.5%, 1%, whatever the figure is. They are making this available without limit at 0.25%. Well, so Alistair, you can see the whole thing. Sorry, go on.
Well, so whether it's a TLTRO or an FRFA or a EIEIO or whatever it happens
exactly.
to be,
the
problem here isn't liquidity, right? I mean, banks have access to massive amounts of capital if they want. In fact, that's one of the things that the negative interest rate, which is on the deposit facility at the ECB, is meant to shoo those funds back out the door, like go do stuff with them. But really, isn't the ECB just really looking at just one side of this? They're kind of saying, hey, banks, go out and lend. But as far as I'm aware, there's two parties in a borrowing lending transaction, and that's the borrowers. It feels to me like there's not, if not a borrower strike, there's just a dearth of ideas to really need to borrow for. Certainly larger corporations who have access to both equity and debt markets, they don't need to borrow money from banks. They can do it through other mechanisms. So is this really a situation where there's just not enough incentive for banks to lend, and if we increase the incentives, they'll find loans to make? Or is it that there's a dearth of borrowers? Where are we in this story?
I think it's a polarization. I mean, over successive credit cycles, what's happened is that companies that have access to securities markets, bond markets, or alternatively are cash rich, are the sort of people that these banks would like to lend to, but they don't need the money. So you've got a situation now where the companies which do need the money are basically in trouble without the money. And that, from a banking proposition, is not a good idea. Mm-hmm. The banks themselves are actually very frightened of the situation they find themselves in. And, of course, they have responsibility usually to shareholders. In some cases, it's very, very often to an individual government. But you can see that, I think the position of a director of a bank is very difficult because, you know, on the one hand, he's being told by his government, he's also being told by the ECB, you've got to lend money to bust institutions. And, you know, as a director of a bank, that completely goes against my ethics. And I would sort of think that if I'm being told this by the ECB, then the last thing in the world I should do is lend money to these people. So, you know, I mean, I think the point is that we have yet to see whether these extreme measures will actually work.
Well, so this is
I don't know if that helps.
Well, it's a bit of an experiment, right? So let's back up then. Probably 4 or 5 months ago, we got our first hints that this was coming. And so this means that whatever the ECB has been looking at has been in play for a long time. On the surface, the thing that they talk to the public about is this idea that 0.5% inflation is just a dangerous situation. Well, let's start there, because I do think that needs to be explained and unpacked a little bit. Is the fact that my flat screen TV costs a little less this year than last year, how is that harmful to a bank?
Well, I sympathize with your analysis, but we need to look at it from the ECB's point of view. And remember that the ECB is stuffed full of Keynesians and monetarists. The number one belief that they have is deflation is death. So on that basis, they don't examine whether, you know, actually something is priced correctly or incorrectly. But what they see, if you like, if I put it in terms which you and I would maybe discuss it, they are concerned that there is an increasing preference for money over goods. And when that happens, it drives the price of goods down. And they are worried that they are essentially on a tipping point where that could well happen. And to illustrate this point, I think I'm right in saying that today the Italy, Holland, and the Portuguese economies actually contracted in the first quarter of 2014. And France, which is a biggie, had zero growth. Now, you can see that if you've got declining, falling prices in this environment, how if you look at prices relative to the mountain of debt that these countries owe, you can see that suddenly all sorts of ratios start looking very, very nasty. And it's that, I think, that the ECB is absolutely desperate to stop.
Well, let's spell this out. So if prices are falling, what we're really saying is that they're worried about a preference demand where people are going to prefer to hold money and they're just going to wait for prices to continue to fall. But does that really hold water historically when we look at things? Like first of all, people's discretionary income might fall under that a little bit, but let's look at non-discretionary items. So if you need to put gas in your car, or petrol in your auto to get from point A to point B to get to work, you're probably a little bit price insensitive to that. Food you're going to buy no matter what. Your housing is probably a fixed expense. There are a variety of fixed expenses that to me seem completely immune to this process. Are they really worried about that people are going to save more than they spend? And if that's part one of the question, then part two is that such a bad thing after we went through this horrendous period of really advancing our debt loads to, across the entire OECD, the total debt loads of the nations now average 350% debt to GDP. First, does falling prices really inhibit spending? And second of all, is there no sense that maybe the levels of debt are already plenty sufficient and we don't need to encourage them to go higher?
Your question goes to the heart, if you like, of the difference between the approach before Keynes came on the scene, when everybody reckoned that Say's law or the law of the markets made sense, and post-Keynes. Let me put it another way. I think you and I would be supporters of Say's law. Now, that being the case, I think I might say that you and I would say the best way to sort this out is to allow a price adjustment to a level where people actually buy what they want because they can afford it, and that way you would get an economy that would adjust itself automatically, and this process would actually be over quite quickly, probably in a matter of 18 months to 2 years. Companies would go bust because they couldn't adjust. They got too much debt, whatever. Certainly, there would be problems with that. But if we did that, the situation would be resolved. What Draghi is dealing with is a post-Keynesian world where that cannot be admitted. And so his objective, quite clearly, and he is appointed to be head of a bank, a central bank, with the view to keep the show on the road at all costs. And that's really what we're talking about. The level of debt and the amount of malinvestment in the whole system is immense. And at the same time, they are killing all the savings. So, here again, instead of doing what's the sensible thing to do, and that is, for us to save rather than spend, and those savings to be taken by industry and invested in new products to tempt us out of our savings or to tempt us to spend with them. Instead of doing that, they're doing the reverse. They are effectively eliminating savings from the system and replacing it with newly printed fiat money and bank credit. That is the attempt. And I'm bound to say that I think that this is bound to fail. So, it's a real problem. And what the ECB now, where it now finds itself, is it finds itself on the cusp of this failure. And remember that if you've got banks with gearing, some very big banks with gearing of over 40, 50 times, all you need is a fall in prices of 1, 2, 3%, something like that, few companies to go bust, and then those banks are no longer solvent. And it is a nightmare scenario, Chris, it really is.
All right, so the elimination of savings, creating new bank credit, and the idea that these banks are geared 40, 50 times. Let's go over into one part of this story and say the ECB is successful. They get what they want. Presumably what they want is they want banks to go out and start lending again like crazy. They would like to see credit growth really take off. People presumably then at that point are really engaging in a lot of economic activity. They see a lot of economic growth. Is that the plan? And are there any flaws in that plan?
You have summed up the plan, and the answer is plenty of flaws. I think part of this is the reason they've announced this the way they have is they want to drive the euro lower. And I think they feel that if they can have a lower euro, then that will stop prices falling and indeed hopefully perk them up a little bit. But this whole idea of killing savings, I mean, they've been trying to do this, central banks have been trying to do this ever since they bought into the Keynesian theories. It's got us into a cycle of just worse and worse credit defaults. And they're doing exactly the same thing. I mean, you know, they're giving the medicine, which historically has been proven to kill us. They're just doubling the doses. So this is not going to succeed, I fear. And I'm not sure that the very short-term benefits that you sometimes see when they ease a currency are likely to follow through. Because the whole point about driving a currency lower is that you persuade people against all reason that things are looking better. And businesses will sort of employ people because they see that, their margins are improving and they can start selling things again. That's the sort of basically the Keynesian meme. Now, that, I think, has been tried so many times that industry in the Eurozone and indeed elsewhere is no longer persuaded by this argument. So I think everybody's now sitting on their hands and saying, well, we actually don't really want to do very much because we just see risk, risk, risk. And I don't think that the ECB on these measures can actually get round that fundamental problem. Everybody still sees risk. It may drive the euro lower, which may rescue the inflation rate from falling below 0.5%. But I really don't see that it's going to be more effective than that.
I'd like to really jump in on that because there's an extraordinary misdiagnosis going on with this. So inflation, when it's the inflation that the Eurozone really needs, and by needs, I have air quotes up at this point in time, by which I mean so that the banking system can continue to not collapse, that sort of inflation is growth in credit. And when you have growth in credit and people are really borrowing a lot, what you tend to see sometimes associated with that is rising prices for things, right? Because you've got good old monetary inflation going along. But to the extent that they're just looking at prices and saying, that's what we're after, we'd love to see 2% rising prices. And the extent to which you do that by trashing your currency so that your imported food and fuel costs more and your basic raw goods cost more, that's not the same thing as inflation. It's rising prices. But that's just because your currency is falling. And so that works beneficially for a country if and only if you have a positive trade balance. So let me spell that out. If you have a negative trade balance, that is you're importing more than you're exporting, rising prices just kill you, right? Japan is starting to experience this at this point in time. Those hurt. So I could see Germany benefiting from a lower euro. I could see a number of other countries, but not all of them. Do you agree with that analysis? And B, if you do, how does the euro experiment sell higher import inflation to everybody when it's not going to benefit everybody?
I agree with your analysis, absolutely. I mean, if you look at Germany, certainly, Germany, incidentally, is not happy with this at all. The sound money people in Germany don't like this, and I think they're very, very worried. Remember, the ECB is in the same town as the Bundesbank, so I should think this the politics at central bank level in Frankfurt must be very interesting. But you're right, Germany would benefit from a lower euro, and you know the Mercedes and the BMWs of this world would make even more money, which is fantastic. I think that the benefits to Spain and Italy, I mean, what I'm saying is I think they're hardly likely to be even temporary. Usually it would only be temporary because, as you rightly point out, what happens is after a short period of time, you find that the rising prices of imported raw materials begin to catch up with you. Then you have workers who find that they can't live on the salaries that they're getting or the wages they're getting, and they go on strike for more. There is a risk they're going to trigger that series of events if they are half successful. I don't think this will succeed. And I think probably what will happen is that people will end up with wages with lower and lower purchasing power. I don't think that unemployment levels are going to fall, so that people will find it difficult to strike. But what you might get, rather than say individual strikes, is you might get sort of more general social unrest as a result. I can see in a year or two's time, riots in Italy and Spain and all the rest of it, as the inflation that you described, that of rising prices from abroad, really starts squeezing people.
So what we're saying here is it's far from certain that this is going to work as intended. And there's plenty of unintended consequences that could happen here, such as people striking for more wages if they find that their import costs are really starting to eat them alive. Let's wander over to the ways this might not work, the risk side of this. We had zero interest rate policy, the so-called ZIRP, has now been replaced with NERP, the negative interest rate policy. So let's talk about what happens with NERP. One of the things that I see is it's very likely that whatever meager rates of interest people were getting on their saved deposits are likely to go lower. First, would you agree with that? And second, is there a chance that banks might actually start transmitting this negative interest rate policy to savers themselves?
No, I do agree with you. I don't think that they will transmit zero interest rates to savers, or I don't think even current account holders. It's not the same, if you like, as the bank actually putting money on deposit at the central bank. But I think what will happen is that if you save money, basically you get zero interest. So it's no good for savers. And so they're on a dead loss right from the start. I mean, even at sort of mild deflation, under their definition, with inflation falling to around about 0.5%, they are losing year on year on year. This is not good. The only savers who make money are those who are prepared to speculate in bond and stock markets. And of course, those assets have risen recently. But I think it is an absolute disaster that they're destroying savings. I mean, this is not how Germany built her might in the wake of the Second World War. She built her might on savings. And, you have the famed Mittelstand, that sort of medium-sized companies who grew their businesses through a long period of monetary stability, of sound money policies. The ECB is trying to destroy the currency as a means of advancing the overall Eurozone economic performance. And it is, in that sense, a con trick. And I don't think people really fall for it anymore. You're getting less and less of a result from printing money than you might have expected, let's say, on the last cycle.
Less and less. I would say we're getting less and less. But one of the things that you do get with printed money guaranteed is they're basically picking winners and losers, right? So savers got picked as the losers in this story. In the United States, I've seen numbers anywhere from $800 billion to $1.2 trillion. Let's just call it $1 trillion of interest that has not been earned on savings since the beginning of the crisis by savers. So they didn't get that trillion, but somebody else did. And so those people tended to be the big banks and the liquidity centers. And what they've done is they've speculate with it, which was really the Fed's goal. And it sounds like the ECB has the same goal, which is let's make everybody uncomfortable holding stodgy old savings. Let's push them over here into this risk arena. You know, participate with us. We're all in this together. Let's all buy stocks and bonds, and this will all work out. And the thing that drives me a little bit crazy about this is that it confuses printed money with capital. It's treating all money as if money and capital, you can just combine those words. It's the same stuff. Don't bother figuring out which word to use. They're interchangeable. And they're not, right? So what you're talking about savings. So savings to me represent You have a fixed finite amount of money supply, or it's relatively stable. It's a sound money system, and it increases in proportion with the actual durable output of a nation, of a people. And then savings have real importance. Then savings and capital are the same thing. And you can accumulate that capital, and it has its own beneficial way of sorting itself out through an economy. But if we wander over into the big world of central planning, and I now think the United States, Japan, and Europe are all victims of the largest central planning effort ever, just puts the Soviets to shame at their height. And now we've got this confusion, which I see in print all the time. I see full-blown economists saying things like, you know, with the capital that the Fed has created, like, no, they've created printed money. That's one thing. So currency and printed currency then is, we can put as much of it out into the economy as we want. But what we'll note is that the economy just doesn't seem to really respond. This seems to me to be like kind of at the heart of the, I don't really actually want to say Keynesian, because I doubt Keynes would have been fooled by this. But the people who have taken his ideas and now morphed them into this idea that you can print capital, they're not getting what they expected, and their response seems to be to just do more of it. And the concern I have is that, A, they're not learning from it, so they have a flat learning curve on this, and B, that all they're really doing is piling up massive amounts of claims against an economy that's not growing. They're not recognizing that. They're going to do more of the same. Time to double down. When and how does this actually begin to end? What can we look for, Alistair, that tells us that dawning recognition is coming to the center?
I think your analysis is interesting. I could sum it up by saying that the ECB's approach to this is, we're only interested in the banks, and we don't give a damn about the small saver. Let's just go through the mechanism whereby this sort of action from the ECB is actually destructive of an economy. And we have to understand that there is something called the Cantillon effect. And this is named after Richard Cantillon, who was John Law's banker back in Mississippi bubble days. But the guy was so smart, he got out before the whole thing fell over. What he noticed, and he noticed silver in particular coming over from Mexico, and he saw how it drove up prices in Spain first, and as that silver got circulated further afield around Europe, then prices started rising elsewhere in Europe. And this is known as the Cantillon effect. Now, the reason this matters today is that you have a central bank, which is the source of new money, if you like, the silver that's imported, the equivalent of the silver that's being brought in from Mexico. And what are they doing with it? They're giving it to the government, and they're also giving it to the banks. So this is why bankers get lovely bonuses and all the rest of it, and they feel relatively rich. This is why people who are close to the financial system and can game that system walk away with a lot of money and buy huge great houses in London and Monte Carlo and wherever. Mm-hmm. But guess what? The people who don't get this money are the small savers. They're the pensioners. They're the people on low fixed income, you know, the people who clean, and, you know, these people who earn very little, they are the people who are being squeezed. So you can see that if you understand that relationship between the rich and the poor, what's actually happening is that the central bank is enriching the 1 or 2%, but impoverishing probably about 95%. There is a bit in the middle which sort of do all right, like some people who actually own stocks who found that the stock market have gone up. Some people who own their homes in the right area, they found their house price has risen. So you do get some sort of spreading of that effect. But by and large, you could probably say that it's an 80-20 rule. You've only got 20% at the very maximum who are getting any benefit out of this, whereas the 80% are really suffering. Now, if you're going to undermine the living standards of 80% of your population, you are not going to improve your economy. And it actually is as simple as that. And the policies that the ECB, in common with the other major central banks, are trying to impose upon the financial system is doing just that. It is killing the 80% and maybe not killing 20%, but only enriching less than 5%. So it is doomed to fail. The more they go down this route, the more it is doomed to fail. So that, I think, is my analysis of it. And when it's going to fail, which I think was sort of behind one of your questions, when are we going to see this falling over? I don't know. I suspect that the signal will be the price of gold. I expect that. I mean, that is now so incredibly undervalued. If you think fine art has gone up, all these inflation hedges like fine art, property, stocks, and they've been sitting on the gold price. Yet, I was writing a piece only this weekend for Gold Money. We have the Asian bloc, if you like, China and Russia, accumulating gold. All those countries in Asia are accumulating gold. We're talking about 4 billion people saying, thank you very much, Western central banks, for supplying us with our gold so cheaply. We're ditching it. Now, at some stage, that is going to end, and I think it's very, very close. And I suspect that after the end quarter distortions, which we're seeing in the market at the moment, once those are out of the way, I think actually gold could run very, very fast and furiously. And that, I think, would be the signal that something has gone horribly wrong.
Yeah, certainly one of the signals I'm looking at. And there was a very subtle point in there earlier that I really want to tease out because it's really important. And I realize I have to be more careful in the future how I've talked about this. Because I've said before, you can't print prosperity out of thin air. And you can't print purchasing power out of thin air, but it's not quite right. So with the Cantillon effect, it's I think the truth is you can print purchasing power. The problem is you can't create real purchasing power. So the banks print it up and the bankers get very real bonuses that allow them to buy very real things, whether it's fine art or trophy mansions in London or even 1,000 acres in the countryside. The printed money has real purchasing power, but it couldn't create real value. So that purchasing power that was printed up, where did it come from? Well, it has to come from somewhere. Because if you can't create something out of nothing, then the mystery is to solve where it came from. I think what's increasingly obvious to people is that it's coming from the 80%, right? It's coming from their reduced opportunities, their reduced standards of living, the increasing difficulty they find to make ends meet. It has to come from somewhere. So the longer this printing effort continues, the summary I have is the greater the inequalities will grow, the injustice of it. And it's the injustice that creates the flashpoints for us monkeys. You know, that's the thing that gets people up out of their seats and into the streets.
Precisely. And, you know, if only Monsieur Piketty in his recent best-selling novel, I call it a novel because it's not based on fact, had actually understood this, then, my goodness, wouldn't the world be a better place? If mainstream economists understood what you have just said, we wouldn't be in this mess, but we're in this mess because they think that by trying to kid us about the value of money, that they can print some money and it's not going to affect the value of our savings. I mean, you know, we wouldn't have got into this situation if they hadn't tried to kid us. And I'm sort of beginning, well, sort of thinking this through, this 80-20 rule. I think I'm going to amend it probably to somewhere over 90% and mm-hmm. probably somewhere less than 10%. Yep. Because it is a very serious point. And this is why it will never, ever work. I mean, if you think about the situation in the Weimar Republic, If they had measured Germany's GDP in those days, I mean, guess what? GDP would have been fantastic. But actually, it's just a reflection of collapsing prices. And the difference between those prices being recorded and the transactions even taking place. So, you know, or put another way, the deflator, when you've got accelerating inflation, is always insufficient to adjust the GDP number. And if you take that lesson, if you like, or that example, and apply it to today, we know that the prices of goods and services are actually rising more rapidly than any deflator that's applied to GDP. And if you accept that proposition, then we have been in a recession or a slump, however you like to describe it, since the Lehman crisis, with no let up. And that explains why things are so, you know, just getting worse and worse. So the central bankers have statistics which they're operating off, which are completely wrong and misleading them. I mean, it is, you couldn't make it up really, Chris.
Well, is this a case, you know, in 2008, we had the opportunity to just rip the Band-Aid off and let the bad companies go bust and let all of the direct loans go into default and then pick ourselves up and move on. I was an advocate for that, by the way, because that actually lets the chips fall where they belong in the hands of those who place their bets wrongly. And I think that teaches important lessons. But, you know, there's another side to that, which is, well, what they've done is they're really allowing us to peel the Band-Aid off slowly. But I actually don't see any peeling going on at all. I see structural imbalances. I see too big to fails, even larger. I see the derivatives tower only larger. I see sovereign nations only further in debt. I see all of these key indicators just actually heading in the wrong direction. And so do you think that this is just another version, what we're seeing coming out of the ECB? Is this just another can kick, a little more extend and pretend, but that ultimately all we're doing is actually building up the potential energy for whatever reckoning comes to a larger amount? Or are they actually helping to diffuse this so that we can hopefully fall off three rungs down the ladder instead of three rungs higher when the time comes?
I think it's extend and pretend, extend and hope, keep your fingers crossed that something will work. I don't think it's more sophisticated than that. And in any analysis, you know, going back to the difference between, the laws of the market, Say's law, and the Keynesian approach, if you go with Say's law, you know this is going to fail, and you understand why it is going to fail. The idea of stimulating one side of the economy is a complete nonsense, and that's what they're trying to do. And it's not going to work. It doesn't get rid of bad debts. It creates even more problems. And the idea that it's a sort of a Band-Aid, if you like, or a plaster on a wound, I don't think that's a good analogy, because what they're doing is they're making the wound worse and pretending that it's better. I mean, it is an appalling situation, and this is not going to help any economic recovery. If anything, over time, because of this transfer of wealth from the poor towards those, you know, sort of lucky bankers and so on and so forth, it's just going to make the situation worse. There is another aspect of this which I'd just like to touch on, and that is that government is a big beneficiary of all this printed money.
Of course.
And that what they do is they end up, if you like, providing welfare to people who need it, as well as jobs for bureaucrats and all the rest of it. But, you know, what welfare is actually provided into the economy has the effect of holding food and energy prices higher than they would otherwise be. So it's not that the, the 80 or 90% are actually, finding that prices aren't rising, because the government is distributing money back into food and energy through people who God bless them need it. They are getting squeezed by the prices at the same time, and we are seeing this. I mean, obviously it's a bit hidden by weather effects. I mean, before we came on air, we were talking about the drought in California, and that doesn't help. And pork prices, I understand, are getting very tight as well, and there's a sort of Chinese situation there. I don't analyze these things, but I can see that all these sort of accidents suddenly seem to be happening about food prices and potentially about energy prices as well. And the root of it basically is printed money and expanding bank credit.
Well, this gets us to the part of the story which just drives me absolutely insane, which is that the bankers, the central bankers, ECB, the Fed, they seem to be entirely unaware of the energy situation that we're in right now. And in Europe, it's completely mysterious to me. I'm trolling the sites all the time. I must be going to the wrong ones, because I can't find anybody talking at all about this rather dire situation that seems to be developing, where relations with Russia are not good. Russia inks this extraordinary multi-decade deal with China to start supplying a huge amount of natural gas over to China. It's not clear that Russia can open the stopcocks and actually get that amount out of its particular reservoirs and to be able to send that off in addition to all of its current exports that happen to go to Europe in large measure. And then when you look at Europe's natural gas situation, a third is supplied by the Groningen field up there in Holland, right? And that's going into decline at this stage. A third of all gas on the European continent comes from one field, which is in decline and is about to really start to go into serious decline in the next 10 years. And so I'm looking at the overall energy landscape, and then I look at the food landscape, where you mentioned, you know, pork. I'll take it to my favorite subspecies of pork, bacon. Bacon's up 53% over the last 4 years. Ground beef is up 35% over the last 4 years. Oranges are up 35%. Coffee, 31%. Peanut butter is up 30% over the last 4 years. These are all statistics that were just released in April. So we've got pretty extreme across-the-board food price hikes, and now we're going to see energy situations become even more dire. To me, those are two great reasons to say, wow, we've got to make sure that our monetary policy is in accordance with these other realities. Complete divorce. If they're talking about it, they never do it in public.
You're right. A different department, I think, is the answer to that. I'm fascinated in your analysis of the European gas situation. Yes, I mean, this was going to happen anyway, because China and Russia are getting together to basically run the Asian continent. And as I said earlier, the Asian continent is 4 billion souls. America is, what, 350 million, something like that, 400 yeah. million. Europe is about another 700 million. I mean, I think between the EU and America, we're looking at around about a billion people. Asia, we're talking about 4 billion people, and they are rapidly becoming prosperous. I mean, you know, big middle classes all over the place. That is where the future is. So quite naturally, actually, Russia and China have been working on deals like this, you know, sort of cross-border gas supply deal. They've been doing things like hydroelectricity from Siberia into China and so on and so forth. It's an extension of what was happening anyway. I think that the Ukrainian situation, you know, might have triggered the timing a little bit, but, you know, it's happening. And not only that, but when I look at what's going on in the Pacific with China irritating Japan, irritating Vietnam, irritating Indonesia, irritating the Philippines, actually, I think what she's saying is, she's saying, for example, to the Vietnamese people, look, if you come into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, come in with us, not with America, then we will leave you alone, because we have no interest in pursuing a debate as to who owns what if you're in the same camp with us. And I think that's the natural outcome. So we're seeing huge, great tectonic shifts going on here with, I think, a big new market in Asia. And what you will find is that more and more energy will be diverted away from places like Europe in towards Asia, into itself. So what we've seen there is the beginning of a trend. It's not just a one-off. And I was interested about your analysis on the Dutch situation, the Netherlands situation, because, yes, I mean, you know, if we've got real declines in supply coming from that source, then we're going to have to bid up to get that stuff in from Russia. I don't know what the price would be. I mean, I would think that Europe might find itself settling above a market price in order to secure energy.
Well, absolutely. And you know, that field that I mentioned, the Groningen field, is discovered in 1959, first put into production in 1961. And guess what? It's old. And if I'm in Europe, there is nothing more important than the energy situation, period. End of story. I would be very, very careful about my relations with people who are in a position to ship me energy supplies. And by the way, that's a shrinking list as we go forward. It's extraordinary. That is first, second, and third, the top strategic priority that I would have if I was in charge of any continent or set of continents. And it seems, it's amazing. I talk with bankers, I talk with politicians, I talk with a lot of people from Europe who it's just, they kind of all go, oh, well, that's kind of interesting. Yeah, that seems rather interesting.
And then dismiss it.
Yeah, so I'm sure somebody's looking at it. I'm trying to find that person, right, who actually is in a position of real power, because the people who do talk about it are all these sort of fringy geologists, you know, people working in sub-departments and whatnot. but it really is going to be coming front and center. And it's that's the key analysis here, which is if you're printing like crazy into the maw of a beast that feeds on energy, and energy is going into limiting supply, there's just an amazing discontinuity between, you know, the reality on the one hand and the printing on the other. It's the same, by the way, it's the same exact situation that Japan, only Japan's doing it under even more dire circumstances in the U.S., but we're all doing it. It's just astonishing. So the bottom line is that what I see in this NERT policy of the ECB, this increasing desperation to just get things working again, you know, as fast as possible, is an absolutely profound inability to correctly diagnose where we are in this story, and just trying what used to work, because it used to work. Nobody gets in trouble for trying what used to work. We'll just try it harder. But where's the recognition that we are X many years into this particular crisis, and nobody's really saying, should we really just be doing more of what got us here?
I think I've sort of thought of an analogy.
Good. What you got?
Let us assume there's a fruit machine, and there are a couple of old pensioners there, and you know they've put most of their money into the fruit machine, and they've got just a little bit left, and you know already they can't really feed themselves, and they had the decision: do we put our last pound or dollar into this machine in order to try and win our money back, so that we can feed ourselves? What do we do? And that's rather like the central banks. They're around the fruit machine. And they've played this bloody machine. And, you know, it's actually got them absolutely nowhere. It's taken all their money. It's chewed up all their money. And it's not giving much in return. And every time they get a little bit in return, they get sort of encouraged. So they put a bit more in and it goes. And they're now down to their last play. And I think that's the analogy I would come up with, and I can't think of a better way of describing it.
So our instinctive hardwired gambling approach is going to be our downfall once again.
I'm afraid so.
All right, so as we get to the end of this, what are you looking for in summary? What are you looking for to know that this isn't working, or that they're going to do more, or that this is basically falling apart? You said, you know, rising gold prices obviously would be a great signal for a lot of people, some sort of hiccup in the financial markets. But what are you looking for here? What are you keeping track of?
Well, I think the other thing that I'm keeping track of is the economic performance of the major trading blocks. We see Japan is in a state of collapse. I mean, it's the only way to describe it. We've just discussed the European situation, so we won't go over that again. And I look at the UK. On paper, we look quite good. But I was actually thinking the other day, the banks have unwittingly put 22 billion of cash into the economy in a way in which they never foresaw. And these are fines for selling unneeded insurance against, if you like, losses on bank accounts or on credit cards. 22 billion is what they have had to pay their customers over mis-selling protective insurance. So now that money gets circulated a bit, and in an economy of this size, 22 billion, I think, is roughly about 1.4% or something like that. Now, given it gets circulated around a few times, you can take that out of our economy. And have we grown? I don't think so, really, because all GDP is it's a money total. So I don't know that we're all that smart either. And then I look at the US, and it's been clear to me that your economy has been struggling hugely. And I think that attempts to blame disappointing numbers on the winter weather and so on and so forth, I think have missed the basic point. And that is that the US is unable to print its way out of trouble. That's already failing. So all round, I see things beginning to sort of go over the cliff a bit. And I'm just watching those GDP numbers. And I would suggest that Peak Prosperity listeners bear in mind that when you look at GDP, the deflators are always underestimated. So if you have got a GDP that, say, rises 3%, it's probably contracting 2 or 3% if you put a true inflation number in there. So that's what I think. That other than the gold price, which I follow moment to moment, that I think is probably the thing I look at most.
Well, all right. Those are some of the things I look at as well. And I am watching credit spreads, which are just perilously narrow at this point in time. Credit spreads meaning meaning the difference in interest rate between ultra safe and ultra junky bonds. The ultra safe should have a low rate. The ultra junky ought to have a high rate. That would be a wide spread, but we have very, very narrow tight spreads. So we have low volatility in the equity markets. We have all-time highs on the equity markets. We have all-time lows on the spreads. It's just a spring coiled. And so it's priced for perfection. The ECB moves in concert with what the Bank of Japan and the Fed have done have said there's something less than perfection under the covers that they're looking at because they're freaking out. And they're doing things that when your central bank is doing something completely unprecedented in world history, you might want to say maybe things aren't completely rosy at this moment in time. Might be something else going on here. So we have all our financial markets priced for perfection. We've got bankers that are scared on the other. I think anybody reading the smoke signals from the outside without knowing really what's happening, under the covers fully, might want to just say, huh, this might be a good time to hedge my bets, cover my bets, and otherwise secure, batten the hatches down for myself personally.
Become risk averse. Yes, I would agree with that analysis entirely, Chris.
All right. Well, Alistair, thank you so much for your time, and I'm glad you're back off holiday so that we can get you lodged in front of your computer screen where you belong.
Thank you very much. I don't think. It was very much my pleasure.
All right, thank you.